previously on the history of America's 1%.
With three railroads now firmly in Vanderbilt's grasp, he set out to take control of the Erie Railroad. However, this particular endeavor would prove quite bothersome for the Commodore, as it pitted him head-to-head in a struggle to keep hold of the Erie against the notorious Jason Gould. Although Vanderbilt was bested in the battle, he still managed to recoup his losses by fleecing investors for about $44 million after he bribed numerous laws through the state legislature, which legalized his water stock and expanded the rights of all his franchises. His aim now was to begin combining his railroad lines so that he could, of course, commit greater and greater securities fraud. The middle class was extremely worried that their own power and loot might be jeopardized by these massive consolidations of wealth. They continually went to Congress and assailed them with petitions for investigations to expose the great magnates, and they demanded new laws to protect their own fraudulent fortunes. For it must constantly be remembered, and we cannot say it enough, that fraud was persistent across the entire American economy all through the ages. From the mightiest railroad baron who bribed senators and congressmen, to the lowly shopkeeper who rigged the weight of his scales.
You get up and howl about America and democracy. There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today. We no longer live in a world of nations and ideologies. The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome back once again to another episode of the History of America's 1% podcast, a series where we dive into the long and shadowy history of America's ruling elite through the works of authors who were either silenced, suppressed, or forgotten, to discover the origins of the 1% and from where their power and wealth was, and still is, extracted. And this is episode number 26 of the podcast, where we will be once again diving into a very, very illuminating book called The History of the Great American Fortunes by Gustavus Myers, who was a self-taught, muckraking journalist, author, and historian who published some of his best work around the turn of the 20th century. So this week, I'm not going to give a long introduction. We're going to try to get right into it right away here because, I've had some issues the last couple weeks. First of all, I just want to apologize for not getting the podcast out last week. Had some technical difficulties. I'm not going to bore you with it too much, but basically I had to re-record the audio for this chapter twice. So now I've read this chapter about 5 times and just had some issues. The microphone died, had to get a new cord for that. And it just took a while. Things came up, so I apologize. To make it up for you, though, I've taken the rest of this chapter, which I was originally going to split into 2 parts. I trimmed out a lot of the extra talking I did in there, and now we're putting it as an hour and a half episode of this podcast. So you're getting 2 for 1 because I'm a little behind. So there you go. So with my mea culpa out of the way, let's get right to the meat and potatoes now. As for the format, I always try to keep the podcast down to about 1 hour in length for easy digestion and consumption of the material. I will only be interrupting the reading of the book to offer my insider interpretation wherever I feel it's necessary. I'm trying to cut back, guys. I know some of you said less talking, more reading. We're not just trying to memorize the facts in the book. Sometimes a little interpretation goes a long way. I find it useful, at least when I listen to other podcasts. So, you know, I'm sorry if it breaks up the narration too much, but it's what I do. Also, I will only be interrupting the reading to spell any last names, because I tend to butcher pronunciation, and I feel like some of these old obscure historical figures, it'll be easier for you to go research them if you know how to spell their name. I'll also be interrupting to provide readings of any footnotes that are in the book. Now, Myers, his work is well researched and thoroughly documented, and a lot of times the footnotes contain more than just a citation, so if they're extended conversations on a particular topic, I'll read those in. Otherwise, I'll just note the footnote, and when I post the episode, you can always go onto the website. It's fileandclaw322.wordpress.com, or you can go on Twitter at fileandclaw322, and there'll be a link to the website from my profile. Go there, and I'll have all the footnotes posted in plain text, or you can always just grab a copy of the ebook, which is also on the website, and check out the footnotes there. And I implore you to do that. If anything in this book sounds incredible or you don't believe it, please, please, please go to the book, go to the website, look at the footnotes, and do your own research and see if he's lying or not. I found this book to be very credible and well-sourced. Take that with a grain of salt, though. Always do your own research. And finally, if there's any words that I come across that I have no idea, I'll give you the definition. Myers, tends to use big, eloquent, and fancy. Now, somebody called them $10 words. Other than that, we're going to jump right into it now. Hopefully you got enough about the chapter from the opening montage. Basically, we're going into Vanderbilt still. The great super patriot, the benevolent benefactor, the American industrial titan, Commodore Cornelius Vanderbilt. I think, if you go back now to episode 21, where we first started delving into Vanderbilt, and listen to that, the mainline history for the man, which was brought to you by History.com, I think we've pretty much torn the accusations and assumptions and assertions, there we go, that's the word I'm looking for. We've torn the assertions in the mainline history absolutely apart and shredded them. So, without further ado, let's get into the episode today. As we continue on the long and sordid trail that Vanderbilt took to becoming one of the most powerful men in the country. And a pioneer, quote-unquote, of the railroad industry. Alright, here we go. Part 3, chapter number 5, The Vanderbilt Fortune Increases Manifold, continued. The Wisdom of Grand Larceny. Now it was that one could see with greater clearness than ever before how the mercenary ideal of the ruling class was working out to its inevitable conclusion. Society had made money its god and property its yardstick. Even in its administration of justice, theoretically supposed to be equal, it made, quote-unquote, justice an expensive luxury available in actual practice to the rich only. The defrauder of large sums could, if prosecuted, use a part of that plunder, easily engage a corps of shrewd and experienced lawyers, get evidence manufactured, fight out the case on technicalities, drag it along for years, call in political and social influence, and almost invariably escape in the end. And doesn't that kind of sound like the justice system today, where it's just about, whose side has more money, we'll get in there and we'll crank it along on some technicality and file appeal after motion and just try to bankrupt the other side. This was back in the 1870s we're talking about, and Gus has noted here for us that, yes, even back in the 1870s, justice was a rich man's sport. Again, the interesting parallels between the history of the country and our current day state of affairs. It's nothing new, folks. But beyond this power of money to make a mockery of justice was a still greater, though more subtle, factor which was ever an invaluable aid to the great thief. Every section of the trading class was permeated with a profound admiration, often tangibly expressed, for the craft that got away with an impressive pile of loot. The contempt felt for the pickpocket was the antithesis of the general mercantile admiring view of the man who stole in grand style, especially when he was one of their own class. In speaking of the piratical operations of this or that magnate, it was common to hear many businessmen interject, even while denouncing him, quote, "Well, I wish I were as smart as he," unquote. These same men, when serving on juries, were harsh in their verdicts on poor criminals, and unctuously flattered themselves with being, and were represented as, the upholders and conservers of law and moral conduct. And just let me break right there and just unwind this little paragraph here, because Gus Myers is making a very interesting fact in his usual elaborate style, which I like. But basically he's saying that the reason why justice was such a rich man's sport, and why these magnates essentially were allowed to commit crime after crime with little repercussion, is that because the prevailing thought at the time amongst those in the middle class, is what he's talking about, the factory owners and the small traders, these were the middle class, the prevailing thought at the time was that they wanted to get to that upper echelon where the magnates played, where they ruled with an iron fist and had money. That's all, it's always been the same. Everybody wants to be rich, right? You want to have two cars, you want to live in a mansion. It's natural. It's a natural outcome of the system where we want to move to that higher level where we don't have to struggle for things and have to worry about paying bills and this and that. So this was going on even back then. I mean, it's been the same all throughout the history of the country. And these men, even though they knew that the robber barons, the magnates, were committing crimes to make their money. They would bribe legislatures, a crime. They would commit securities fraud, a crime. They would have perjurers come in and give evidence, a crime. And so even though people knew that they were committing crimes to make their money, it generally they were looked up to by these people. He said, you know, they'd sit there and they'd talk bad about him and curse him and denounce him and be like, you know, these criminal bastards are ripping everybody off, blah, 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 blah. And at the same time, they turn around and be like, well, I just wish I was as smart as he was. Meaning that, you know, if only they had the the wits or the ambition or probably more likely the moral bankruptcy to commit these crimes against the great number of people, they do the same thing to get to that upper echelon, and that's what it takes. I mean, and that's demonstrable from what we've seen in this book. If you want to be a great magnate, basically you have to run a criminal empire. Now, the difference is they held that, you know, these men who wrapped themselves up in an air of moral superiority at the time, they were the upper classes, you know, the better class, so to speak. They would look down and disdain, and they'd sit on the juries and sentence the pickpocket, right? Whatever the circumstances, whether he was driven to that by sheer necessity or just from some a purely criminal act, these people would be put in jail. The poor pickpocket would be thrown in jail for a long sentence. However, when the great magnate came and stole, you know, let's say $30 million from the public treasury and then watered the stock and committed securities fraud for another $44 million, nothing would happen to them. Oh, maybe they'd get dragged in front of the Congress, but as we saw with Vanderbilt, in the end, he got his name completely expunged from the record despite hard evidence, which we looked at in the congressional testimony, linking him to the crime of committing naval contract fraud and swindling the government out of money for ships that were worthless. So you can kind of see how that sharp discrimination worked. And the whole thing that Myers is pointing out is that's because people in the middle class wanted to be up in the upper echelon where these men played, in this upper strata, this realm. And so they had a profound admiration for these men, even though they were constantly in fear of them, you know, swooping in and stealing their fortune. It's just kind of a sad, unusual commentary on the way the system works. But anyways, I took up plenty of time on that. Let's get on with the book. I just think that's important. Again, these discriminations in law, and we still see these things today. You know, you or I commit a crime, just think, we sit on the jury and we would pass a harsh judgment. Oh, well, he broke into somebody's house and stole a television. Oh, well, you're going to have to send him to prison. Or, well, we caught him with, you know, a couple grams of some kind of illegal narcotics on him. You know, he could be a danger to the society. You better throw him in jail. But look at what happens when you sell junk securities and derivatives on the market and you lie about what they are and you crash the entire economy, put millions of people out of jobs, steal their pensions, foreclose on their homes, sometimes even when you didn't even own them. And what happens? They never go to jail. It's the same story, folks. It's been going on since the start of the country. There was never some time where justice was doled out in this country fair and properly. I mean, get it? You got to get it through your mind right here. This is a fact. Continuing with the book now. Ugh, getting me wound up on this. Departing from the main facts, as this philosophical digression may seem, it is essential for a number of reasons. One of these is the continual necessity for keeping in mind a clear and balanced perspective. Another lies in the need of presenting aright the conditions in which Vanderbilt and magnates of his type were produced. Their methods at basis were not a growth independent of those of the business world and isolated from them. They were simply a development, and not merely one of standards as applied to morals, but of the mechanism of the social and industrial organization itself. Finally, it is advisable to give flashlight glimpses into the modes and views of the time. Inasmuch as it was in Vanderbilt's day that the great struggle between the old principle of competition, as upheld by the small capitalists, and the superseding one of consolidation, as incarnated in him and others, took on vigorous headway. He continues the buying of laws. Protest as it did against Vanderbilt's merging of railroads, the middle class found itself quite helpless. In rapid succession, he put through one combination after another and caused theft after theft to be legalized, utterly disdainful of criticism or opposition. In state after state, he bought the repeal of old laws, or the passage of new laws, until he was vested with authority to connect various railroads that he had secured between Buffalo and Chicago into one line with nearly 1,300 miles of road. The commercial classes were scared at the sight of such a great stretch of railroad, then considered an immense line, in the hands of one man, audacious, all-conquering, with power to enforce tribute at will. Again, Vanderbilt patronized the printing presses, and many millions of stock, all fictitious capital, were added to the already flooded capital of the Lake Shore and Michigan Southern Railroad Company. Of the total of $62 million of capital stock in 1871, fully one half was based upon nothing but the certainty of making it valuable as a dividend payer by the exaction of high freight and passenger rates. A little later, the amount was run up to $73 million, and this was increased subsequently. Whew, again, securities fraud, hello. Vanderbilt now had a complete railroad system from New York to Chicago, with extensive offshoots. It is at this point that we have to deal with a singular commendation of his methods, thrust forward glibly from that day to this. True, his eulogist admitted then, as they admit now, Vanderbilt was not over-scrupulous in getting property that he wanted. But consider, they urge, all the improvements he brought about on the railroads that came into his possession, the renovation of the roadbed, the institution of new locomotives and cars, and the tearing down of the old and worn-out stations. This has been the praise showered upon him and his methods. Inquiry, however, reveals that this appealing picture, like all others of its sort, has been ingeniously distorted. The fact was, in the first place, that these improvements were not made out of regard to public convenience, but for two radically different reasons. The first consideration was that if the dividends were to be paid on the huge amount of fabricated stock, the road, of necessity, had to be put into a condition of fair efficiency to meet or surpass the competing facilities of other railroads running to Chicago. Second, the number of damage claims for accident or loss of life arising largely from improper appliances and insufficient safeguards was so great that it was held cheaper in the long run to spend millions for improvements. Yeah, railroad crashes and derailments are only useful when you're trying to batter down the stock to get control of it once you have it. Well, then these loss of life claims and, you know, other inconveniences like that, they start to wear on you. Jerks. All right, here we go. Public funds for private use. Instead of paying for these improvements with even a few millions of the proceeds of the watered stock, Vanderbilt and all other railroad magnates in like cases did the same, forced the public treasury to defray a large part of the cost. A good illustration of his methods was his improvement of his passenger terminus in New York City. The entrance of the New York Central and Harlem Railroads is by way of Park, formerly 4th Avenue. This franchise, as we have seen, was obtained by bribery in 1832. But it was a qualified franchise. Ah, it reserved certain nominal restrictions in behalf of the people by inserting the right of the city to order the removal of the tracks at any time that they became an obstruction. These terms were objectionable to Vanderbilt. A perpetual franchise could be capitalized far more than a limited or qualified one, and a perpetual franchise was what he wanted. The opportunity came in 1872. From the building of the railroad, the tracks had been on the surface of 4th Avenue. Dozens of dangerous crossings had resulted in much injury to life and many deaths. The public demand that tracks be depressed below the level of the street had been resisted. Instead of longer ignoring this demand, Vanderbilt now planned to make use of it. He saw how he could utilize it not only to foist a great part of the expense upon the city, but to get a perpetual franchise. Thus, upon the strength of the popular cry for reform, he would extort advantages calculated to save him millions, and at the same time, extend his privileges. It was but another illustration of the principle in capitalist society to which we have referred before, and which there will be copious occasion to mention again and again, that after energetically contesting even those petty reforms for which the people have contended, the ruling class have ever deftly turned about when they could no longer withstand the popular demands, and have made those very reforms the basis for more spoliation and for a further entrenchment of their power. Footnote number 15. And let's take a quick look at footnote number 15 here. Gus Myers notes that while thus taking advantage of the public demand for the removal of the Fourth Avenue perilous conditions, Commodore Vanderbilt insisted upon retaining railroad surface tracks on 11th Avenue, long called Death Avenue, from the number killed by trains on that thoroughfare. A Senate committee in 1866 had reported, quote, "The traction of freight and passenger trains by ordinary locomotives on the surface of the streets is an evil, which has already endured too long and must speedily be abated." Unquote. Successive generations of Vanderbilts remained deaf to the public outcry against the conditions on Death Avenue, and it was not until 60 years after the Senate Committee report that steps were taken to eradicate the evil. So, basically, in 1866, there's the cry for depressing the tracks on 11th Avenue, which was called Death Avenue, because so many people were killed by the trains on that crossing. He resisted this cry for another 60 years. So it's not like he was some, he's like, oh, we don't want people to be injured, see? He did all these repairs on 4th Avenue in the 60s and 70s, and he depressed the track. What a great man. No. He did this when it was fortuitous. He did the repairs on 4th Avenue because the time was right to get the city to pay for some of the repairs. And at the same time, he slipped through his perpetual franchise for his railroad. He didn't do it out of the kindness to the public or some regard for safety. And that's evidenced by him waiting 60 years to fix conditions on a track that was even more dangerous. It was so goddamn dangerous, they called it Death Avenue, folks. That's what Myers is pointing out. So all his apologists and eulogists and the people, his favorable biographers who said he was a great innovator and he improved the railroads and made them safer. Nah, he did it whenever he could work some scheme in with it, you know what I mean? Or whenever the public, it was so outrageous that it just couldn't be tolerated anymore. Sorry to put that in there, but let's continue on with this footnote here. The stimulus. Now he's talking about 60 years later, fixing Death Avenue. The stimulus to this action came in 1926 when a $300 million state bond issue for the elimination of railroad grade crossings became available. Ah, so there we go. Once again, finally a $300 million state bond issue. So they're going to defray some of the costs for the old Vanderbilt dynasty there. As there were 105 grade crossings along and up the 11th Avenue route, the idea occurred to some astute minds that here was an opportunity of effecting an improvement to be paid for partly out of the public funds, an improvement that, whatever the expense to the railroad company, would be to it an asset of enormous value. an engineering company appointed by the mayor to develop a plan, submitted its report in May of 1927. An agreement between city and state boards and railroad company was made on July 2, 1929. The estimated cost of the whole plan of effacing New York Central and Hudson River Railroad grade crossings and building viaduct and subway and making other changes from near Canal Street to Spuytonville was, at the time, put at $175 million. The railway to pay $110 million, the city of New York about $50 million, and the state of New York $15 million. The first stage of the improvement, a viaduct from the new terminal at Spring and Washington Streets to 30th Street, was completed and dedicated in June of 1934, and much progress has been made on the remaining sections northward, comprising a subway or cut to 60th Street and the covering by the city of the tracks through Riverside Park. All right, there's the end of that footnote. So again, it's so critical. These knuckleheads who say that Vanderbilt fixed stuff because he cared about the safety and regard for the public. Give me a break. You just tell them about Death Avenue. Death Avenue. They literally called it that. I should go back and look up the newspapers from that time and see if it's I can find any mentions of it in the old newspapers. Death Avenue. All right, let's get back to the book now. That was a long footnote. And we were talking about the plan now of Vanderbilt in 1872 for him to depress the tracks on 4th Avenue, or Park Avenue, I think it's called now. So we're talking about his plan to do the 4th Avenue and how he defrayed some of the costs to the city and state and how he got his perpetual franchise. So we're going to look at the scheme, okay? Here we go. The first step was to get the New York Common Council to pass, with an assumption of indignation, an ordinance requiring Vanderbilt to make the desired improvements and committing the city to bear one half the expense and giving him a perpetual franchise. Oh yeah, the city's gonna bear one half of the expense. This was in Tweed's time, and that name, that's William M. Tweed of Tammany Hall fame, and I'll just hit his name one more time here. Tweed, T-W-E-E-D. This was in William Tweed's time when the Common Council was composed largely of the most corrupt ward heelers and when Tweed's puppet, Hall, was mayor. Public opposition to this grab was so great as to frighten the politicians. At any rate, whatever his reasons, Mayor Hall vetoed the ordinance. However, from the Tweed-controlled legislature, Vanderbilt in 1869 obtained the first requisite legislation. Chapter 919 of the laws of that year authorized the practical seizure of both city and private property on 42nd Street and northward to 45th Street, to enable the New York and Harlem Railroad Company to construct a new passenger station. New York City was ordered to close portions of 4th Avenue and of 43rd and 44th Streets and turn the entire area over to the company for its exclusive use. There was a provision in the Act for compensation, but whether any was ever paid to the city, or if so, what the amount was, cannot be ascertained from any public records, at least. The controller's records and many other reports covering those years have long been missing. The Act of 1869 also compelled the city, at public expense, to create for the benefit of the company a street on the west side of the station and, additionally, authorized the company to lay down curves, switches, and turnouts contiguous to the station. The operation of the tracks on the surface of 4th Avenue has so depreciated the value of real estate, along that thoroughfare that it could be bought for trifling sums. Just before Vanderbilt caused another act of sweeping powers to be enacted in 1872, the New York Central Railroad Company bought much real estate property on both sides of 4th Avenue. I smell a scheme brewing here. I don't know if anybody, if you've ever lived in a, a city with a large, like, downtown area, commercial type area. But I lived somewhere recently where they had to shut down a huge, huge portion of the downtown area. And let me tell you, businesses, when they can't get traffic down into that area and the sidewalks are all closed, and it's just generally a pain to get around because of construction, businesses get hammered and crushed. And I'm sure if they had to shut down this giant chunk of city in New York, that just as what happened where I was, I'm sure many businesses and things like that go out of business. And Gus noted, too, that with all the accidents, that the real estate value had been battered down quite a bit. So I'm betting that Vanderbilt's scheming because he's going in there and buying this property up. The legislature of 1872 was elected in 1871 following the revelations of the Tweed Ring frauds. It was regarded as a, quote, model reform body, unquote. As has already been remarked in this work, the pseudo-reform officials are bodies elected by the American people in the vain hope of overthrowing corruption, will often go to greater lengths in the disposition of the people's rights and interests than the most hardened politicians, because they are not suspected of being corrupt, and their measures have the appearance of being enacted for the public good. The Tweed clique had been broken up, but the capitalists who had assiduously bribed its members and profited so hugely from its political acts were untouched and in greater power than ever before. The source of all this corruption had not been struck at in the slightest. Tweed, the politician, was sacrificed and went to prison and died there. The capitalists who had corrupted representative bodies everywhere in the United States, before and during his time, were safe and respected and in a position to continue their work of corruption. Tweed made the classic, unforgivable blunder of going into politics as a business, instead of into commercialism. The very capitalists who had profited so greatly by his corruption were the first to express their horror at his acts. Ah, yes. From the quote-unquote reform legislature of 1872, Vanderbilt secured all that he sought. The act was so dexterously worded that while not nominally giving a perpetual franchise, it practically revoked the qualified parts of the Charter of 1832. It also compassionately relieved him of the necessity of having to pay about $4 million in replacing the dangerous roadway by the construction of a tunnel by imposing that cost upon New York City. New York City was then in bad financial condition after its looting by the Tweed regime. William F. Havemeyer, and again that last name, Havemeyer, who became mayor after the overthrow of the regime, protested against saddling the expense upon the city. In his message to the Board of Aldermen in January of 1874, he said, quote, "The question as to the power of the legislature to take from the pockets of the citizens of New York $1.5 million annually to hand over to a railroad corporation to be used for personal profit, as they have done by the aid which the city is compelled to give to the New York Central and Harlem Railroad Companies, in sinking the track and abating a public nuisance, ought, I think, to be tested. Issues should be joined by the city on every such scheme which receives the sanction of the legislature and has for its purpose an application of public monies to secure private interest and the aggrandizement of private property." Unquote. New York City did begin litigation, but later discontinued it. Once the Fourth Avenue improvements were made, Vanderbilt bonded them as though they had been made wholly with private money. Also, after these improvements, the value of the real estate property, which the New York Central Railroad Company had bought on both sides of Fourth Avenue, rose. It cumulatively increased after later and more modern improvements were made on that thoroughfare, now became, as we have said, Park Avenue. The company held on to areas of the land, that's about 20 years ago, through a real estate subsidiary, at least for the erection of great apartments for the rich. Yes, Park Avenue, folks. That's how he bought it up. Reform! Nope. I'll try again. Quote-unquote, reform, as it really works out. But the foregoing were not Vanderbilt's only gifts from the quote-unquote reform legislature of 1872. The Harlem Railroad owned, as we have seen, the 4th Avenue surface line of horse cars. Although, until this time, it extended to 79th Street only, this line was then the second most profitable in New York City. In 1864, for instance, it carried nearly 6 million passengers, and its gross earnings were $735,000. It did not pay, nor was required to pay, a single cent in taxation. Oh, God, that must be nice. Wow. By 1872, the city's population had grown to about 950,000 people. Vanderbilt concluded that the time was fruitful to gather in a few more miles of the public streets. The legislature was acquiescent. Chapter 325 of the laws of 1872 allowed him to extend the line from 79th Street to as far north as Madison Avenue, should thereafter be opened. But see, said the legislature, in effect, quote, how mindful of the public interest we have been. We have imposed a tax of 5% on all gross receipts above 79th Street, unquote. When, however, the time came to collect, Vanderbilt innocently pretended that he had no means of knowing whether the fares were taken in on that section of the line, free of taxation, below 79th Street, or on the tax portion above it. He doesn't know. I don't keep track of these type of things. I can just imagine him saying that. We don't keep track of where our money comes from. Give me a break. Behind this fraudulent subterfuge, the city officials were not inclined to go. As a consequence, the only revenue that the city long received from that line was a meager few $1,000s a year. At the very time that he was watering stock, sliding through legislatures' corrupt grants of perpetual franchises, and swindling cities and states out of huge sums in taxes, footnote number 16, Vanderbilt was forcing the drivers and conductors on the 4th Avenue surface line to work an average of 15 hours out of 24 and reducing their daily wages from $2.25 to $2. And back in footnote number 16, when we were talking about Vanderbilt issuing watered stock, sliding through corrupt legislatures' grants for his perpetual franchises, and swindling cities and states out of huge sums in taxes, Myers notes in footnote number 16 that not alone was he, in a tabulated report made public on February 1st, 1872, the New York Council on Political Reform charged that in the single item of surface railways, New York City, for a long period, had been swindled annually out of at least $1 million. And this was quite an underestimate. So there you go. Let's continue on with the book now. Vanderbilt made the pretense that it was necessary to economize, and as was the invariable rule of the capitalist, the entire burden of the economizing process was thrown upon the already overloaded workers. This subtraction of 25 cents a day entailed upon the drivers and conductors and their families many severe deprivations. Working for such low wages, every cent obviously counted in the management of household affairs. But the methods of the capitalist class in deliberately pyramiding its profits upon the suffering of the working class were evidenced in this case, as they had been and since have been in countless other instances. by the announcement in the Wall Street Reports that this reduction in wages was followed by an instant rise in the price of the stock of the 4th Avenue Surface Line. The lower the wages, the greater the dividends. The further history of the 4th Avenue Surface Line cannot here be pursued in detail. Suffice to say that the Vanderbilts in 1894 leased this line for 999 years to the Metropolitan Street Railway Company. This company, as we shall see, represented a series of lootings. So, tuck that name of that company into the back of your mind for later, the Metropolitan Street Railway Company. Later, the 4th Avenue Surface Line became part of the New York Railways Company, in the bonds of which lay the interest of the New York and Harlem Railroad Company. But street railway lines had become obsolete and unprofitable. The 4th Avenue line was abandoned, and in lieu of its old franchise, a 25-year franchise for the operation of buses was granted in December of 1933 to the Madison Avenue Coach Company, which was required to pay to the city 3% of its gross receipts on the entire route. It is not necessary to enter into a narrative of all the laws that Vanderbilt bribed legislature after legislature and common council after common council into passing. Laws giving him for nothing immensely valuable grants of land, shore rights and rights to land underwater, more authorizations to make further consolidations and to issue more watered stock. Nor is it necessary to deal with the numerous bills he considered adverse to his interests that he caused to be smothered in legislative committees by bribery. Vanderbilt's Chief of Staff. His chief instrument during all those years was a general utility lawyer, Chauncey M. Depew, whose specialty was to impress the public by grandiloquent exhibitions of mellifluent spread-eagle oratory, while bringing the quote-unquote proper arguments to bear upon legislatures and other public officials. Footnote number 17. Everyone who could in any way be used or whose influence required subsidizing was, in the phrase of the day, quote-unquote, taken care of. Great sums of money were distributed outright in bribes in the legislatures by lobbyists in Vanderbilt's pay. Supplementing this, an even more insidious system of bribery was carried on. Free passes for railroad travel were lavishly distributed. No politician was ever refused. Newspaper and magazine editors, writers, and reporters were always supplied with free transportation for the asking, thus ensuring to a great measure their goodwill and putting them under obligations not to criticize or expose plundering schemes or individuals. Oh, yes. All railroad companies use this form as well as other forms of bribery. All right, let me go back to footnote number 17 here and just read this when Myers is talking about how Chauncey M. Depew would impress the public but bring the proper arguments upon the legislators and the public officials. Gus Myers notes that Roscoe Conkling, and his name is R-O-S-C-O-E, Roscoe, and then Conkling is C-O-N-K-L-I-N-G, a noted Republican politician had said of him, quote, Chauncey Depew? Oh, you mean the man that Vanderbilt sends to Albany every winter to say ha and gee to his cattle up there, unquote. So, this Republican politician is basically saying, yeah, Chauncey M. Depew, he goes up to Albany. We know Albany is the capital of New York and probably where the state legislature is. And he goes up there and the legislators are referred to as his cattle. And if they're Depew's cattle, then they're Vanderbilt's cattle too. So you can kind of tell what the proper arguments were. We're talking about bribes and influence and all this stuff. All right, continuing on with the book. It was mainly by means of the free pass system, which was not abolished by congressional legislation until 1906, that Depew, acting for the Vanderbilts, secured not only a general immunity from newspaper criticism, but continued to have himself and them portrayed in luridly favorable lights. Depending upon the newspapers for its sources of information, the public was constantly deceived and blinded, either by the suppression of certain news or by its being tampered with and grossly colored. Hello? That's still going on today. This, Depew continued as the representative of the Vanderbilt family for nearly half a century. Astonishing as it may seem, he managed to pass among the uninformed as a notable man. He was continuously eulogized. At one time he was boomed for the nomination for President of the United States, and in 1905, when the Vanderbilt family decided to have a direct representative in the United States Senate, they ordered the New York State Legislature, which they practically owned, to elect him to that body. It was while he was a United States Senator that the investigations in 1905 of a committee of the New York Legislature into the affairs of certain life insurance companies revealed that Depew had long since been an advisory party to the financial maroundings carried on by Hyde, and that last name H-Y-D-E, the founder and head of the Equitable Life Assurance Society. The career of Depew is of no interest to posterity, footnote number 18, excepting insofar as it shows anew how the magnates were able to use intermediaries to do their underground work for them, and to put those intermediaries into the highest official positions in the country. This fact alone was responsible for their elevation to such bodies as the United States Senate, the President's Cabinet, and the courts. Their long service as lobbyists or as retainers was the surest passport to high political or judicial position. Their express duty was to vote or decide as their master's interest bid them. So it was that men who put their cunning and brains at the complete disposal of the magnates filled Congress and the courts. These were, to a large extent, the officials by whose votes or decisions all measures of value to the working class were defeated, and reversely, by whose actions all or nearly all bills demanded by the money interests were passed and sustained. And let me roll it back here, the footnote number 18, where Gus Myers noted that the career of Depew is of no interest to posterity. He notes that certain facts may be, however, when he died at the age of 94, in 1928, he was widely eulogized by a list of financial and political notables as a man whose geniality of disposition and nobility of character had been an inspiration to his fellow citizens. Oh, man. Newspaper biography said that he had attained his two ambitions. One, that of becoming president of the New York Central Lines, and the other, that of election to the United States Senate. The net value of his estate was appraised in 1930 at $15,954,249. He owned more than $500,000 of shares and bonds in New York Central Lines, and was a stockholder in a host of other corporations, including the Pullman Company. Ah, yes, the Pullman Company. And just as an aside, we covered that back in episode number 15, so if you want a refresher on the Pullman Company and their methods in business and the people involved there, we covered specifically Marshall Field, just roll it back to episode number 15. Continuing on now with the book. After having bribed legislatures to legalize his enormous issue of watered stock, what was Vanderbilt's next move? The usual, fraudulent one of securing exemption from taxation. He and other railroad owners sneaked through law after law by which many of their issues of stock were made non-taxable. So now old Shaggy Vanderbilt loomed up the richest magnate in the United States. His ambition was consummated. What mattered it to him that his fortune was begotten blackmail and extortion, bribery and theft? Now that he had his 100 millions, he had the means to demand adulation and the semblance of respect, if not respect itself. The commercial world admired, even while it opposed him. In his methods it saw at bottom the abler application and extension of its own, and while it felt aggrieved at its own declining importance and power, it rendered homage in the odd, reverential manner in which it viewed his fortune. Over and over again, even to the point of wearisome repetition, must it be shown, both for the sake of true historical understanding and in justice to the founders of the great fortunes, that all mercantile society was permeated with fraud and subsisted by fraud. But the prevalence of this fraud did not argue its practitioners to be inherently evil. They were victims of a system inexorably certain to arouse despicable qualities. The memorable difference between the two classes was that the workers, as the sufferers, were keenly alive to the abominations of the system, while the capitalists not only insisted upon the right to benefit from its continuance, but harshly sought to repress every attempt of the workers to agitate for its modification or overthrow. Repression by starvation. These repressive tactics took on a variety of forms, some of which are not ordinarily included in the definitions of repression. The usual method was that of subsidizing press and pulpit in certain subtle ways. By these means, facts were concealed or distorted, a prejudicial state of public opinion created, and plausible grounds given for hostile interference by the state. But a far more powerful engine of repression was the coercion exercised by employers in forcing their workers to remain submissive on instant peril of losing their jobs. While at the same time manufacturers, jobbers, and shopkeepers throughout the country were rising in angry protest against the accumulation of plundering power in the hands of such men as Vanderbilt, Gould, and Huntington, they were themselves exploiting and bribing on a widespread scale. And that last name there, Huntington, I don't think we've covered him before, but that's spelled Huntington. Their great pose was that of a thorough commercial respectability. It was in this garb that they piously went to the legislatures and demanded investigations into the rascally methods of the railroad magnates. The facts, said they, should be made public, so as to base on them appropriate legislation which would curtail the power of such autocrats. Contrasted with the baseness and hypocrisy of the trading class, Vanderbilt's qualities of brutal candor and selfishness shone as brilliant virtues. Footnote number 19. And in this footnote, Gus Myers remarks that no observation could be truer. As a class, the manufacturers were flourishing on stolen inventions. There might be exceptions, but they were very rare. Year after year, decade after decade, the reports of the various commissioners of patents pointed out the indiscriminate theft of inventions by the capitalists. In previous chapters, we have referred to the plundering of Eli Whitney and Charles Goodyear, but they were only two of a vast number of inventors similarly defrauded. In speaking of the helplessness of inventors, J. Holt, last name H-O-L-T, the Commissioner of Patents, wrote in his annual report for 1857, quote, "The insolence and unscrupulousness of capital, subsidizing and leading on its minions in the work of pirating some valuable invention held by powerless hands, can scarcely be conceived by those not familiar with the records of such cases as I have referred to. Inventors, however, gifted in other respects, are known to be confiding and thriftless, and being generally without wealth and always without knowledge of the chicaneries of law, they too often prove but children in those rude conflicts which they are called on to endure with the stalwart fraud and cunning of the world," unquote. And that comes from the U.S. Senate documents, first session, 35th Congress, 1857 to 58, volume number 8, pages 9 to 10. In his annual report for 1858, Commissioner Holt described how inventors were at the mercy of professional perjurers, whom the capitalists hired to give evidence. Oh, great. There we go again. The bribing of patent office officials was a common occurrence. The attention of Congress, reported Commissioner of Patents Charles Mason in 1854, quote, is invited to the importance of providing some adequate means of preventing attempts to obtain patents by improper means, unquote. Several cases of, quote-unquote, attempted bribery had occurred within the year, stated Commissioner Mason. And that comes from Executive Documents, First Session, 33rd Congress, 1853 to 54, Volume 7, Part 1, pages 19 to 20. Every successive Commissioner of Patents called upon Congress to pass laws for the prevention of fraud and for the better protection of the inventor, but Congress, influenced by the manufacturers, was long deaf to these appeals. Whew. So there you go, nothing but fraud. Fraud, fraud, fraud in the middle class. Nothing but fraud. Let's get back to the book now. These same manufacturers objected in the most indignant manner, as they similarly do now, to any legislative investigations of their own methods. Ha ha! Eager to have the practices of Vanderbilt and Gould probed into, they were acrimoniously opposed to even criticism of their factory system. For this extreme sensitiveness, there was the amplest reason. The cruelties of the factory system transcended belief. In, for instance, the state of Massachusetts, vaunting itself for its progressiveness and enlightenment and culture, the textile factories were a horror beyond description. Oh, here we go, the ultimate hypocrisy, Massachusetts, who is so the liberal progressive bastion. It still is today, they still write it off like that. Here we go, you want to hear about what really happened, how these people, these so-called liberal state, was a bunch of hypocrites? Here we go. The convention of the Boston 8-Hour League in 1872 did not overstate when it declared of the factory system that, quote, it employs tens of thousands of women and children 11 and 12 hours a day, owns or controls in its own selfish interest the pulpit and the press, prevents the operative classes from making themselves felt in behalf of less hours through remorseless exercise of the power of discharge, and is rearing a population of children and youth of sickly appearance and scanty or utterly neglected schooling, unquote. As the factory system was in Massachusetts, so it was elsewhere. Any employee venturing to agitate for better conditions was instantly discharged. Spies were at all times busy among the workers, and if a labor union were formed, the factory owners would obtain sneak emissaries into it with orders to report on every move and disrupt the union, if possible. The factory capitalists in Massachusetts, New York, Illinois, and every other manufacturing state were determined to keep up their system unchanged, because it was profitable to work children 11 and a half hours a day in a temperature that in summer often reached 108 degrees and in an atmosphere certain to breed immorality. Footnote number 20. It was profitable to compel adult men and women having families to work for an average of 90 cents a day. It was profitable to avoid spending money in equipping factories with life-saving apparatus. Hence, these factory owners, forming the aristocracy of trade, savagely fought every move or law that might expose or alter these conditions. The annals of legislative proceedings are full of evidences of bribery. Wow. Unbelievable, unbelievable. And in footnote number 20, when Gus Myers was talking about the conditions in, I guess, what you could only describe as these sweatshops in Massachusetts and elsewhere, where the children were forced to work in an atmosphere in the factories that, quote, were certain to breed immorality, unquote, Myers' remarks in footnote number 20, see the report of Carol D. Wright, Massachusetts Bureau of Statistics of Labor, for 1881. And that name is Carol, C-A-R-R-O-L, last name Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T. He further notes that a cotton mill operative testified, quote, young girls from 14 and upwards learn more wickedness in 1 year than they would in 5 outside of the mill, unquote. See also the numerous recent reports of the National Child Labor Committee. So there you go. A good old liberal progressive bastion, Massachusetts. They ran sweatshops, folks. It wasn't even that long ago. 1880s. Who knows how long that system went on. I guess when child labor was outlawed, supposedly, or I mean not supposedly, but I think that was in the 1920s or something. Somewhere around there when child labor was outlawed. But I mean, this is just over 100 years old, and yet we look down and we criticize Apple and Nike and Foxconn with their sweatshop factories and their child labor in China and their suicide nets, and we look down and we say, oh, how uncivilized they are, how unbelievable it is. Yet just 100 years ago, in Massachusetts, what is supposed to be a progressive bastion, you had sweatshop factories with women and children working 11 and a half hours a day for practically nothing in America. Thanks, massholes. No, I'm just kidding. I don't want to go too hard on Massachusetts. It was like that everywhere. You get singled out because of the pretensions that the state makes and the politicians of being a liberal and progressive bastion. They always point to Massachusetts. They're like, oh, look at the great liberal and progressive bastion of Massachusetts. Come on, folks, it's a myth. They had sweatshop factories about 100 years ago. Anyways, let's get back to the book now. Having no illusions and being a severely practical man, Vanderbilt well knew the pretensions of this trading class. With many a cynical remark, aptly epitomizing the point, he often made sport of their assumptions. He knew, and none knew better, that they had dived deep in bribery and fraud. They were the fine gentlemen, he well recalled, who had generally obtained patents by fraud, who had so often bribed members of Congress to vote for a high tariff, the same, too, who had bribed legislatures for charters, water rights, exemptions from taxation, the right to work employees as long as and under whatever conditions they wanted to. This manufacturing aristocracy professed to look down upon Vanderbilt socially as a coarse sharper, and in New York a certain ruling social element, the native aristocracy, composed of old families whose wealth, originating in fraud, had become respectable by age, took no pains to conceal their opinion of him as a parvenu, and drew about their sacred persons an amusing circle of exclusiveness into the rare precincts of which he might not enter. And just as an aside here, if you want to go back, and I know it's been quite a while since we covered this, but if you want to get some of the background history on the native aristocracy, right, these old landed families who, as Gus Myers correctly points out again, obtained their huge estates through fraud and bribery and all the other things, but given the passage of time, it became a respectable fortune. If you want to go back and learn about the families like the Livingstons and the Van Rensselaers and other families like that, and Myers covers specifically more of New York, but he gets into a few families elsewhere. If you want to go back and get the deep history of them, it's episode number 2 of this podcast. Continuing on with the book now. Vanderbilt now proceeded to buy social and religious grace as he had bought laws. The purchase of absolution has ever been a convenient and cheap method of obtaining society's condonation of theft. In medieval centuries, it took a religious form. It has become transposed to a social traffic in these superior days. Let a man steal in colossal ways and then surrender a small part of it in charitable, religious, and educational donations. He at once ceases being a thief and straightway becomes a noble benefactor. Vanderbilt now shed his lifelong irreverence and gave to Deems, that last name, D-E-E-M-S, a minister of the Presbyterian Church, as a gift, the Church of the Strangers on Mercer Street, and he donated about $1 million for the founding of Vanderbilt University at Nashville, Tennessee. The press, the church, and the educational world thereupon hailed him as a marvel of saintly charity and liberality. Yep, that's the way it goes. The sermonizing of the quote-unquote best classes. One section of the social organization declined to accept the views of the class above it. This was the working class. Superimposed upon the working class, draining the lifeblood of the workers to provide them with wealth, luxuries, and power, were those upper strata of society known as the quote-unquote best classes. These best classes, with a monstrous presumption, airily proclaimed their superiority and incessantly harped upon the need of elevating and regenerating the masses. And who, it may be curiously asked, were the classes self-destined or self-selected to do this regenerating? The commercial and financial element, with its peculiar morals so adjusted to its interests that it saw nothing wrong in the conditions by which it reaped its wealth, conditions that made slaves of the workers, threw them into degradation and poverty, and made the industrial field an immense concourse of tears, agony, and carnage. Hanging on to this supreme class of wealth, fawning to it, licking its very feet, were the parasites and advocates of the press, law, politics, the pulpit, and, with a few exceptions, of the professional occupations. These were the instructors who were to teach the working class what morals were. These were the eminences under whose guidance the working class was to be uplifted. Now, hold on, let's hold it up right here. As I'm reading this, I'm thinking, doesn't this sound familiar? Where have I heard this before? You see, back in these days, Myers was talking about how these so-called better or the best classes, right? Because that's how they thought of themselves, as the better, the moral superiors of these lowly workers and you know, people like that, the lower classes. And they would say, well, we just have to lift them up. Yes, we must lift them up. Now, who was saying this? Who was saying this back then? He says it was the press, the lawyers, the politicians, the pulpit, which would be the churches, and with few exceptions, the professional occupations. Now, this, I think, is a lens. Myers is giving you a lens here to look at where we are right now in the future. Where do we hear the same kind of rhetoric today? What do they talk about? I'm telling you right here, we are being attacked with the same rhetoric all the time. But it's not the lower classes anymore. They don't call them the lower classes. Now it's called the middle class. We got the same thing. Oh, we hear about all the time. Oh, we got to protect the middle class. And oh, the middle class is being destroyed. And oh, the middle class made America. And we have to lift up the workers and the poor into the middle class. You seeing a parallel there? I am. Who's attacking us with this rhetoric these days? Oh, think about it. The politicians, the mainstream media. Oh, well, they always ask, what can we do to raise up the middle class? Lawyers, and even the big businessmen themselves. Now, all these people, the professional occupations, the churches, the lawyers, the politicians, the press, all these people were constantly bombarding you with this rhetoric of protecting the middle class and raising up the middle class. What did Myers describe them as? The parasites, the bootlickers of the robber barons. And so I think with this lens, we can take this today and look at the people who always tell you about the middle class or lecture you on how the middle class is so great and how we need to just uplift these poor saps who are poor or out of a job and put them into the middle class. Just take a look at who they are really beholden to. And you're going to find that it's our current robber barons are today robber barons. This is the sermonizing of the best classes. This is a very interesting lens that we can use because we are still being bombarded with this rhetoric today, same as it was back in the 1870s. Let's continue on with the book now. Let us turn from this sickening picture of sordid arrogance and ignorance, so historically true of all aristocracies based upon money, from the remotest time to this present day, and contemplate how the organized part of the working class regarded the morals of its quote-unquote superiors. While the commercial class, on the one hand, was determined on beating down the working class at every point, it was, on the other, unceasingly warring among itself. In business dealings, there was no such recognized thing as friendship. To get the better of the other was held the quintessence of mercantile shrewdness. A flint-hard, brute spirit enveloped all business transactions. The businessman who lost his fortune was generally looked upon without emotion or pity, and condemned as an incapable. For self-interest, businessmen began to combine in corporations, but these were based purely upon mercenary aims. Not a microscopic trace was visible of the spirit of fellow-kindness, sympathy, collective concern and brotherhood already far developed among the organized part of the working class. As the supereminent magnate of his day, Vanderbilt was invested with extraordinary publicity. He was extensively interviewed and quoted. His wars upon rival capitalists were matters of engrossing public concern. His slightest illness was breathlessly followed by commercialdom and its outcome awaited. Hosts of men, women, and children perished every year of disease contracted in factories, mines, and slums. But Vanderbilt's least ailment was given a transcending importance, while the scourging sweep of death among the lowly and helpless was utterly ignored. Oh, geez, Gus, I thought we were going to turn away from this sordid picture. He's going right back into it. Precisely as mercantile society bestowed no attention upon the crushed and slain, except to advance roughshod over their stricken bodies while throwing out a pittance in charity here and there, so Vanderbilt embodied in himself the qualities that capitalist society in mass practiced and glorified. It was strong men, says Crofit, quote, whom he liked and sympathized with and not weak ones, the self-reliant, not the helpless. He felt that the solicitor of charity was always a lazy or drunken person, trying to live by plundering the sober and industrious. Unquote. This malign distrust of fellow beings, this acrid cynicism of motives, this extraordinary imputation of evil designs on the part of the penniless, was characteristic of the capitalist class as a whole. Itself practicing the lowest and most ignoble methods, governed by the basest motives, plundering in every direction, it viewed every member of its own class with suspicion and rapacity. Then it turned about, and with immense airs of superiority, attributed all of its own vices and crimes to the impoverished masses which its own system had created, whether in America or elsewhere. The apologist may hasten forward with the explanation that the commercial class was not to be judged by Vanderbilt's methods and qualities. In truth, however, Vanderbilt was not more inhuman than many of the contemporary shining lights of the business world. Honesty and industry analyzed. If there is any one fortune commonly praised as having been acquired by, quote, honesty in industry, unquote. It is the Borden Millions, made from cotton factories. And that last name is Borden, B-O-R-D-E-N. At the time that Vanderbilt was blackmailing, the founder of this fortune, Colonel Borden, was running cotton mills in Fall River. His factory operatives worked from 5 o'clock in the morning to 7 in the evening, with but 2 small half hours of intermission, one for breakfast and the other for dinner. The workday of these men, women, and children was thus 13 hours. Their wages were wretchedly low, their life was one of actual slavery. Insufficient nourishment, overwork, and the unsanitary and disgusting conditions in the mills prematurely aged and debilitated them, and were a constant source of disease, killing off considerable numbers, especially the children. Oh, man. In 1850, the operatives asked Borden for better wages and shorter hours. This was his reply. Quote, I saw that mill built stone by stone. I saw the pickers, the carding engines, the spinning mules, and the looms put into it, one after the other. And I would see every machine and stone crumble and fall to the floor again before I would accede to your wishes. Unquote. Borden would not have been amiss had he added that every stone in that mill was cemented with human blood. His operatives went on a strike. They stayed out 10 months, suffered frightful hardships, and then were forced back to their tasks by hunger. Borden was inflexible, and so were all the other cotton mill owners. Footnote number 21. It was not until 1874, after many further bitterly contested strikes, that the Massachusetts legislature was prevailed upon to pass a 10-hour law, 24 years after the British Parliament had passed such an enactment. Wow. And let's roll it back there very quickly to footnote number 21, where Myers was talking about how inflexible Borden and all other cotton mill owners were. He notes, but the heroism of the cotton operatives was extraordinary. Slaves themselves, they battled to exterminate Negro slavery. The Spinners' Union, says McNeil, and that last name, M-C-N-E-I-L-L, quote, was almost dead during the Civil War, as most of its members had gone to shoulder the musket and to fight. To strike the shackles from the Negro, a large number was slain in battle, unquote. And that comes from a book called The Labor Movement, page 216-217. And I just want to throw this in there so I don't get any emails about this little point of Myers here. Yes, it's true that there were many, many, many concatenating circumstances involved in the Civil War. It wasn't just for freeing the slaves. I think we can look back and see that pretty clearly. That wasn't the only aspect, even though it's painted like that in the mainline history, that, oh, Civil War, end of slavery. Well, no, there's a lot of stuff going on. However, I think the point made here is still pretty valid, that these people probably went off to fight the slaves, or to fight, not fight the slaves, but fight for the freedom of the slaves. I mean, a lot of the common folk back then, you gotta think, they didn't know about all the other motives, all the backdoor deals that were going on. They didn't care about the economics of war and the, having all these shipping ports and stuff like that. I mean, probably the ending of chattel slavery was what was sold to these people to get them to go fight, so. You know, it's probably a fair point that they went off. They were true believers in fighting for the abolition of slavery. So, just, I understand the point, but don't send me any emails about, well, the Civil War was about this or that or that. It was about a lot of things, okay? And slavery, the ending of it, was one of them. Let's continue on with the book here. The commercial class, high and low, was impregnated with deceit and dissimulation, cynicism, selfishness, and cruelty. What were the aspirations of the working class which it was to uplift? The contrast stood out with stark distinctness. While businessmen were frantically sapping the labor and life out of their workers and then tricking and cheating one another to seize the proceeds of that exploitation, The labor unions were teaching the nobility of brotherly cooperation. Quote, "Cultivate friendship among the great brotherhood of toil," unquote, was the advice of Uriah Stevens, and his name Uriah, U-R-I-A-H, first name, last name Stevens, S-T-E-V-E-N-S, master workmen of the Knights of Labor, at an annual meeting of that organization on January 12, 1871. And he went on, quote, "And while the toiler is thus engaged in creating the world's value, how fares his own interest and well-being? We answer, badly, for he has too little time and his faculties become too much blunted by unremitting labor to analyze his condition or devise and perfect financial schemes or reformatory measures. The hours of labor are too long and should be shortened. I recommend the universal movement to cease work at 5 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, as a beginning. There should be a greater participation in the profits of labor by the industrious and intelligent laborer. In the present arrangements of labor and capital, the condition of the employee is simply that of wage slavery. Capital dictating, labor submitting, capital superior, labor inferior. This is an artificial and man-made condition, not God's arrangement and order. For it degrades man and ennobles mere pelf. It demands those who live by useful labor and, in proportion, exalts all those who eschew labor and live, no matter by what pretense of respectable cheat, for cheat it is, without productive work." Unquote. Labor's principles ignored. Such principles as these evoke so little attention that it is impossible to find them recorded in most of the newspapers of the time, and if mentioned, it was merely as the object of venomous attacks. In varying degrees, now in outright abuse, and again in sneering and ridicule, the working class was held up as an ignorant, discontented, violent aggregation, led by dangerous agitators and arrogantly seeking to upset all business by seeking to dictate to employers what wages and hours of labor should be. And after all, little it mattered to the capitalists what the workers thought or said, so long as the machinery of government was not in their hands. At about the very time Master Workman Stevens was voicing the unrest of the laboring masses, and at the identical time when the panic of 1873 saw several millions of men workless, thrown upon soup kitchens and other forms of charity, and battered wantonly by policemen's clubs when they attempted to hold mass meetings of protest, an Iowa writer, D.C. Cloud, last name C-L-O-U-D, was issuing a book which showed concretely how thoroughly government was influenced by the commercial and financial classes. This book, obscurely published and now scarcely known except to the patient Delver, is nevertheless one of the few serious books on prevailing conditions written at the time, and is in marked contrast to the reams of printed nonsense then circulated. Although Cloud was tinged greatly with the middle-class point of view, and did not see that all successful businesses were based upon deceit and fraud, yet, so far as his lights carried him, he wrote trenchantly and fearlessly, embodying series after series of facts exposing the existing system. He observed, "A measure without any merit, save to advance the interest of a patentee or contractor or railroad company, will become a law, while measures of interest to the whole people are suffered to slumber and die at the close of the session from sheer neglect. It is known to congressmen that these lobbyists are paid to influence legislation by the parties interested, and that dishonest and corrupt means are resorted to for the accomplishment of the object they have undertaken. Not one interest in the country nor all other interests combined are as powerful as the railroad interest. With a network of roads throughout the country, with a large capital at command, with an organization perfect in all its parts, controlled by a few leading spirits like Scott, Vanderbilt, Jay Gould, Tracy, and a dozen others, the whole strength and wealth of this corporate power can be put into operation at any moment, and congressmen are bought and sold by it like any article of merchandise." Footnote number 22. All right, that's the end of chapter 5. So there you go. One finds some parting wisdom there from another author that congressmen are bought and sold like any article of merchandise. Man. Some great information in that chapter. It sure ran long, so sorry about that. But I hope you enjoyed, and stick around next time. We'll be digging further and further, my friends, into the Vanderbilt fortune. You ain't seen nothing yet. All right, thanks for sticking around. As always, you've been listening to the History of America's 1% podcast, where we have been reading The History of the Great American Fortunes by Gustavus Myers, the muckraking journalist, author, and historian who published some of his most prolific work from the turn of the 20th century. And as always, this is the information that you're not supposed to know about. It is at this point that we have to deal with a singular commendation of his methods, thrust, force, thrust, fo, 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 boop, boop, beep, boop, boop.